Hello, my name is David Emery, and this is For the Record program number 355, titled The Ties That Bind, Part 3. This broadcast is being recorded on April 14th of the year 2002. We're going to begin this broadcast with an excerpt of an article that I'm going to read into the record in its entirety in For the Record program number 356. This article is entitled The Swastika and the Crescent. It was authored by Martin A. Lee, the author of the vitally important recent book, The Beast Reawakens, that we've used many times on this broadcast. I've interviewed Martin Lee a number of different times about his book. This article was published in the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Report, their issue number 105 from the spring of 2002. You can visit their website at www.splcenter.org, one word. We're going to begin our discussion of the ties that bind by reading a couple of paragraphs that begin Martin Lee's article. Again, the article, The Swastika and the Crescent, subtitled, In the Wake of September 11th, New Light is Thrown on the International Ties Increasingly Linking Muslim and Neo-Nazi Extremists. This is authored again by Martin A. Lee. Notice here the vision of Adolf Hitler as the Third Reich was facing military defeat. And as Martin Lee notes quite appropriately, coordinate this or mesh this psychologically with what people saw on September 11th. As Germany's defeat loomed during the final months of World War II, Adolf Hitler increasingly lapsed into delusional fits of fantasy. Albert Speer, parenthetically Hitler's architect, later Minister of Defense, in his prison writings, recounts an episode in which a maniacal Hitler pictured for himself and for us the destruction of New York in a hurricane of fire, unquote. The Nazi Führer described skyscrapers turning into gigantic burning torches, collapsing one upon another, the glow of the exploding city illuminating the dark sky, unquote. An approximation of Hitler's hellish vision came true on September 11th when terrorists destroyed the Twin Towers in New York, killing nearly 3,000 people. But it was not Nazis or even neo-Nazis who carried out the attack. The deadliest terror strike in history allegedly came at the hands of foreign Muslim extremists. By the way, I would note that as Martin Lee goes on to describe in considerable detail, there are very strong connections between these. I have talked about those connections many times in many broadcasts. We will be talking about those to a certain extent later on in this program, and we will come back to them in future broadcasts. That article, again, The Swastika and the Crescent by Martin A. Lee in the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Report, issue number 105, the spring of 2002. Now, in connection with the Islamo-fascist / neo-Nazi connection, and in fact, the Islamic Nazi connection. This should not be misunderstood as characterizing Islam as either fascist or Nazi, but there is a very strong connection between powerful elements within Islam and fascism, past and present. And some of those connections, such as Youssef Nada, are ongoing. We're going to take a look now at an article that appeared in the Wall Street Journal this past week being Thursday, April 11th of 2002. This is an article by Michael M. Phillips and Ian Johnson. It's titled, U.S. European Divisions Hinder Drive to Block Terrorists' Assets. And this alludes to some of the financial fronts that were apparently utilized in September 11th and a disagreement between Europe and the United States over some of the freezing of some of the assets. The article is Dateline Paris, and it reads in part, The U.S. drive to separate terrorists from their money is hitting roadblocks amid an international dispute over whether America is too heavy-handed or Europe is too timid. 7 months after President Bush vowed to, quote, starve the terrorists of funding, unquote, American officials are complaining that allies have contributed few names to a list of 192 alleged terrorist financiers whose assets the U.S. wants frozen and haven't moved against everybody on that list. Some Europeans counter that the U.S. hasn't provided enough evidence to back up its requests, and isn't doing enough to crack down on offshore tax havens that can provide cover to terrorists. Neither Germany nor France has contributed any names to the list, which the U.S. initiated, of accounts to be frozen. Some other European countries' contributions seem aimed chiefly at local problems. Spain has added 21 names, all alleged extremists from its restive Basque region. Britain has contributed 6, all allegedly involved in violence in Northern Ireland. By the way, I would add that a subsidiary of Mercy International, in turn a derivative of Al-Taqwa, which we're going to talk about some more in a moment, has been alleged by British intelligence to be involved in funding an offshoot of the IRA or perhaps an agent provocateur of Northern Irish Protestant group. Continuing. The U.S. Treasury Department says Germany and France, the latter with especially strong Arab ties, have each ordered banks to block accounts of just 140 of the 192 people and entities on the list. That leaves untouched, for instance, any accounts of several organizations allegedly tied to Hamas, the Palestinian group that has taken responsibility for many suicide bombings in Israel. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill is currently on a European trip to talk about terrorist finance, a trip with an unstated purpose, to prevent the global crackdown from losing steam. Some European officials, for their part, question whether the U.S. is doing enough on its end, either to chase down its own difficult money trails, such as offshore tax havens, or to provide enough evidence to give European and Arab countries justification to act. Germans complain that the U.S. has been unwilling to share the most useful terror-related intelligence, quote, "We don't feel that we're getting everything from the American side," unquote, said a German intelligence official, again quoting, "Intelligence sharing should be mutual, but we seem to be giving and only getting very basic things in return," unquote. Well, veteran listeners to this program can no doubt see some of the problems inherent in this discrepancy between the European and American attitudes toward terrorist funding. In the background of many of these terrorist or alleged terrorist funding conduits is, of course, what I call the economic component of the Underground Reich, the Bormann Organization, something which will appear to be fictitious to many people, but due to the remarkable work of Paul Manning, who was part of Edward R. Murrow's team in Europe during World War II, he broadcast the surrenders of both Japan and Germany on the CBS radio network, and served as a gunner on board both B-17s and B-29s in order to cover the air raids into both Europe and Japan in World War II. One of the most heroic and one of the best journalists we have ever produced, Paul Manning did a landmark book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile that we're going to access later. And in discussing the Bormann Organization, the greatest concentration of economic power under a single control in world history, as one banker described it, Paul Manning discussed this consummately powerful organization, very secretive, which has profound connections in the United States, including and especially to the Bush administration, and very profound connections in Europe as well. As I've discussed in many broadcasts, there appear to be some very firm connections between the Bormann Organization and the events of September 11th, both in terms of the stock speculation that took place prior to September 11th and in terms of the actual funding of some of the September 11th events. One of the institutions that we've discussed in connection with international fascism, Islamofascism, the Bormann Organization, and September 11th, and that is an organization called Al-Taqwa, which means fear of God in Arabic. Al-Taqwa eventually metamorphosed into Nada Management. Its founder, Youssef Nada, was allegedly involved with German intelligence as far back as World War II. Al-Taqwa is alleged by American officials to have been involved not only with September 11th, but to have been involved with Osama bin Laden and Al-Taqwa even after September 11th. I would note that Altaqua was also alleged in an article that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle on March 12th of this year to have been founded by François Genoux, a very, very important and very mysterious individual who was involved with many of the Third Reich's activities, not only in its above-ground phase, but in its post-World War II below-ground phase. He was also described by many as allocating a key portion of the Nazi funds after World War II. All of the dispensation of the Nazi funds was controlled and controlled very tightly by the remarkable and deadly Bormann organization. And the head of that organization, Martin Bormann, Hitler's right-hand man, and the organizational genius behind Hitler. Anyone who differed with Martin Bormann's views was dealt with by Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo, and the deadly SS organization which he had underneath him. Müller and his SS intelligence outfit described by many as the most effective intelligence outfit in the world, although something most people do not know about. That's discussed, by the way, in For the Record 283. Now, vis-a-vis Altaqua, vis-a-vis the Bin Laden outfit in Europe, the parent organization is called SICOS, the Saudi Investment Company. We're going to take a look at Islam Bin Laden. We're going to take a look at a French and Swiss investigation of Islam bin Laden, the half-brother of Osama bin Laden. And bear in mind that the co-chairman of Islam bin Laden's organization in Europe, SICO, is a fellow named Baudin Dunant. And Baudin Dunant, as we looked at last week, is co-chairman of the board of SICO. Research credit on the following article goes to a member of the listening audience who's been tremendously helpful in recent weeks. This article is from Newsweek's issue of April 8th of 2002, and this is authored by Mark Hosenball of Newsweek, H-O-S-E-N-B-A-L-L. It was Hosenball who authored the very important article that we dealt with in For the Record 352 about Altaqua and Ahmed Huber. This article was co-authored by Peg Tyre, T-Y-R-E, and Allison Langley. It's headlined, Bin Laden, a Half-Brother Under Scrutiny. The article reads as follows. Osama bin Laden's legion of half-brothers and sisters insist that they turned their backs on their radical sibling years ago after he refused to stop his militant agitation against the Saudi royal family. By the way, I would interrupt that there is abundant evidence to the contrary. The landmark book Dollars for Terror by Richard LaBeviere is one of the sources that we've accessed, which presents information to the contrary, shall we say. And a number of information sources, including Weltwoche, a Swiss weekly, and also the FAZ, the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, arguably Germany's most respected daily, have presented viewpoints that differ radically with the assertion here by the bin Laden family. Continuing. But investigators in Europe are raising new questions about the financial dealings of one of Osama's best-known relatives. No charges have been filed anywhere, but after receiving a formal request from the French government, authorities in Switzerland last week raided 13 addresses that they believe are connected to bin Laden half-brother Yaslam bin Laden. Like the rest of Osama's relatives, Yaslam adopted a different family name to distance himself from his infamous kin. Yaslam's Swiss attorney says the raids will ultimately prove his client's innocence. Yaslam manages large bin Laden family investments in Europe and is a longtime Swiss resident. A colorful entrepreneur whose interests include a jet charter business, Yaslam, before September 11th, announced plans to market a bin Laden clothing line. After September 11th, Yaslam condemned the attacks and said he had not been in contact with Osama for 20 years. He threatened to sue anyone alleging that he was involved with terrorists. But French investigators are now taking another look. According to law enforcement sources, French government money laundering experts last year ran across what they considered a series of suspicious financial transactions involving obscure companies connected to Yaslam. By the way, I would interject that in a very important article in the April-May issue of Hit List magazine, a musical publication, or a music publication, I should say. Kevin Coogan, in an article about Ahmed Huber and Altaqua, discussed the viewpoint of Ernest Backes, B-A-C-K-E-S, a European expert on money laundering, that, in the opinion of Backes, the September 11th money trails would go back to a series of organizations set up by François Janoux, again, one of the most important post-war operatives of the Underground Reich, an individual involved with the post-war disbursement of Nazi funds that inevitably as part of the Bormann organization, and an individual alleged in a San Francisco Chronicle article to have been involved with the setting up of Altaqua, and an individual who was represented in 1983 by Baudin Dunant, the co-chairman of the board of SECO, the Bin Laden European organization, that headed up here by Islam Bin Laden. Continuing. The experts alerted judicial authorities, and a French magistrate was assigned to investigate. 10 days ago, French police searched a Bin Laden family villa near Cannes. The French also asked the Swiss to raid addresses linked to Saudi Investment Company, a Bin Laden family investment vehicle headed by Islam. U.S. officials say French investigators are pursuing a possible money laundering and tax fraud case against Islam. An American source says that the French also are looking for any evidence of cash flow to Al-Qaeda, but so far have not found it. Islam strongly denies any ties to Osama. Quote, if the authorities want to look at his companies and his finances, Islam says they're welcome to them, unquote, says his American lawyer Lawrence Schoenbach. He has nothing to hide, unquote. Islam Bin Laden is not the only sibling of Osama's to come under the attention of investigators. Authorities are closely examining a lawsuit in which another Bin Laden brother, Ghalib Mohammed Bin Laden, unsuccessfully sued the Bahamas-registered Altaqua Bank for $2.4 million. U.S. officials say the now-defunct bank was part of an international financial network, also based in Switzerland, that allegedly laundered money to an assortment of terrorist groups. The U.S. Treasury told Congress that Altaqua provided financial support for Osama both before and after September 11th. Altaqua officials deny any connection to terrorists, and some European investigators believe that Ghalib sued Altaqua to help the family distance itself from Osama. Continuing. The family has said its dealings with Altaqua can't, quote, be imputed to connote any hint of support for Osama. The family has repeatedly stated that Osama was ostracized and cut off from family contact and support nearly 8 years ago, unquote. By the way, again, I would add that contradicts the findings of many institutions, including the Wall Street Journal, which noted that one of Osama bin Laden's sons is heavily involved with the management of the bin Laden companies. Now, note the Islam bin Laden denunciation of his alleged involvement with terrorism. I would note that Islam bin Laden has blocked the publication in Switzerland of a French book that we've discussed in For the Record 334, 337, or for the Record 337 and For the Record 349. That book is called Bin Laden, La Vérité Interdite. It was co-authored by two French authors, and it carried the allegation by the late John O'Neill, who was in charge of the Bin Laden investigation for the FBI, who then quit the FBI over his frustration with, as he put it, American corporate connections to Saudi Arabia and Saudi sponsorship of Islamic fundamentalist terrorism. John O'Neill was then, after leaving the FBI, killed in the World Trade Center attacks of September 11th, and his posthumous words were printed in the book Bin Laden, La Vérité Interdite. The following article, which I'm not going to read, it's all in French, and rather than translating it and taking the time to read it in French, I'm just going to basically give you the thrust of what is discussed here. This was published in Le Temps, And it's available on their website, www.letemps.ch. That's L-E-T-E-M-P-S, one word. This article is by Yves Petignat, P-E-T-I-G-N-A-T. It was printed on January 26th of 2002. The headline is, Yeslam Bin Laden bloque la vente en Suisse du livre La Vérité Interdite. It's Dateline Geneva. And what the book discusses is the fact that Yaslam bin Laden maintained, and his counsel maintained, that the book is defamatory to his reputation because this book maintains that Yaslam bin Laden, or implies that Yaslam bin Laden and the Saudi Investment Company, or SECO, were involved in the terrorist activities of his brother, and because of that, his attorneys were able to force the publisher of this, De Noël, to effect some substantive changes in the particular book. Jean-Charles Brizard, one of the co-authors of the book, maintained that the book was this blocking of the publication and forced editing and interdiction of some of the book, some of the passages, was a significant restriction on freedom of the press. So I would note that again in this article from Le Temps, the aforementioned Yaslam bin Laden has blocked the publication of a book that implicated his activities with those of, or that implied that he was involved with his brother's terrorist activities, or his half-brother's terrorist activities. Note again the powerful, the enormous wealth of the bin Laden family, and that some of the putative power of wealth in the civic courts is being used to help block some of the discussion of some of the allegations of the involvement of Yaslam bin Laden. One of the things that we're going to be focusing on in the rest of the broadcast, and that concerns some of the petrodollar connections, because of the tremendous wealth that has been flowing to the Middle East, and in particular to Saudi Arabia, where the Islamo-fascist extreme Wahhabi sect holds sway. Tremendous power has been lent not only to Wahhabism, which in many ways has corrupted the Islamic faith in a very violent direction, but in turn, the tremendous wealth of Saudi Arabia has been recycled not only into very powerful corporate connections, which in turn have helped to limit the investigation into the events of September 11th, but as we will see later in the program, this tremendous oil wealth is also leading to the corruption of American academic institutions and also of the changing of public opinion in an anti-Semitic pro-Wahhabi fashion. And that has had some very significant influence in the public's perceptions of the tragic events now unfolding in the Middle East. Research credit on the following goes to Dave White, our European researcher and translator, who got the following article from L'Espresso of November 1st of 2001. This article is by Francesco Bonazzi. It's headlined, The U.S. President's Dangerous Connections. This alludes to James R. Bath, who was the North American business representative for Salem bin Laden, who was apparently involved in some of the October surprise activities. Salem bin Laden died under strained circumstances in a plane crash in 1988. And this discusses the James R. Bath connection to George Bush Jr., and in turn, the connection of George Bush Jr. to Arbusto Energy and Harkin Energy, and to some of the critical financial institutions that were involved with financing those. The article reads, quote, Money is the lifeblood of terrorism. Today, we ask the world to suspend its financing, said George W. Bush on September 24th, when he announced that the United States had frozen the assets of 27 companies suspected of pumping money into Islamic terrorist networks. But money is also the nourishment of every entrepreneur. And when it is in short supply, one must look for fresh, new sources of finance. The current U.S. president followed in the footsteps of his father. He devoted himself to the search for oil and new financiers. And he unknowingly countenanced personages linked to Saudi money men and Osama bin Laden. In 1976, when George Bush Sr. was appointed to head the CIA, he quickly sold a large number of the clandestine services aircraft to a private company. That company was Skyway, formed by James Bath, a Texan who had been in the military reserve with George Bush Jr. During this period, Bath became the U.S. representative of Saudi millionaire Salem bin Laden, one of Osama bin Laden's brothers. In 1977, Bath gained management control of the Port of Houston, and Bush Jr. founded Arbusto Energy. Within 12 months, Arbusto needed money, so Bath offered the company $50 million. In an embarrassing bulletin issued shortly after the September 11th attacks, the White House tried to say that Bath had invested his own money in the company. Arbusto's financial situation worsened, and in 1986, after a series of mergers, it became Harkin Energy. Among its shareholders and board of directors, George Bush Jr. In the space of a year, Harkin needed money. To save it from bankruptcy, Saudi banker Khalid bin Mahfouz injected $25 million into the company. By the way, bin Mahfouz is being investigated in connection with Al-Taqwa and September 11th. Continuing. By the way, he was also represented by James R. Bath in North America. The transaction was negotiated in great secrecy in Geneva. The money arrived from the Union Banque Suisse and the Bank of Commerce and Credit International, whose principal shareholder was bin Mahfouz. At the end of the 80s, BCCI collapsed, leaving a $10 billion hole. BCCI had laundered money for CIA operations, including support for the Afghan resistance. As for bin Mahfouz, he was not just BCCI's principal shareholder. He also controls Saudi Arabia's largest bank, the Saudi National Commercial Bank, and has been married to a sister of Osama bin Laden. Bin Laden, in turn, counts among his wives a sister of bin Mahfouz. In 1999, the terrorist links of bin Mahfouz were proven, and today he is under arrest in Saudi Arabia. Will any government ever ask for his extradition? Don't bet on it, says Dave Emery. We're going to be continuing with the discussion not only of bin Mahfouz and Salem bin Laden and James R. Bath, but some of the petrodollar connections to the events in and around September 11th. Those have been one of the things that has led to an institutional cover-up of much of what has gone on. Now, we're talking about some of the events in and around September 11th, and as I'm speaking on 4/14/2002, the Middle East has been turned into a tinderbox, and passions are running high and intellects low in connection with that. Well, we're going to be talking about, and this is supplemental to a certain extent to the last couple of For the Record programs, we're going to be talking about capital flow and money and the influence buying of petrodollars. At the end of Side 1, we took a look at an article from L'Espresso, the Italian publication. This was researched and translated for us by Dave White, and this discussed the connections of the Bush family and George Bush Jr. to the petrodollar milieu that not only embraces the bin Laden family, a fabulously wealthy and powerful family, but also the bin Mahfouz family, who are not only related by marriage to the bin Ladens, but also have common business interests, including the business interests of which the Bush family are part, the former Arbusto Energy, later Harkin Energy, and also the Carlyle Group. The bin Mahfouz family, specifically Khalid bin Mahfouz, is also in under investigation in connection with Al-Taqwa and the events of September 11th that we've looked at in many broadcasts. By the way, I can appreciate that for many listeners, many of the things that I'm talking about might appear unfamiliar or incredible. Please use the websites, use WFMU.org/Dave Emery and a linked website to download audio files that are available for free. Also, www.spitfirelist.com. Audible.com, also equipped with Real Audio, has detailed annotated descriptions of all of these programs. They are also available for free and can be emailed around. By the time this program goes out to the various stations that carry it, those programs on September 11th will have been reformatted. I've just completed doing that. This is to make it easier to read and easier to understand. So please utilize the websites and email the stuff around to others. It's free, folks, and you can't beat that price. Now, the petrodollar milieu, its connections to the milieu of September 11th, and also its connection, as we're going to see, to universities and nonprofit foundations, or what in theory are nonprofit foundations in the United States, that in turn are being manipulated by Middle East petrodollars, Saudi in particular, through corporate connections in order to help reshape world opinion vis-a-vis the events in the Middle East, the Israeli-Palestinian question in particular. In the L'Espresso article, we took a look at James R. Bath, his disposal of aircraft that had been sold off by the CIA when the elder George Bush was director of that agency. Bath himself was allegedly connected to the CIA. He also was a primary investor in George Bush's energy company. In that regard, he served as the representative for not only Salem bin Laden, Osama's brother, but also for Khalid bin Mahfouz. People who knew Bath at the time said that he didn't have much money of his own, so in all likelihood, the $50 million he put forward for Arbusto Energy came from his Saudi clients, including the family of Osama bin Laden. Khalid bin Mahfouz was one of the principal people involved with the BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. One of the things that we're going to take note of here concerns some of the financial antecedents of Harkin Energy. Turning once again to the L'Espresso article, Arbusto's financial situation worsened, and in 1986, after a series of mergers, it became Harkin Energy. Among its shareholders and board of directors, George Bush Jr. In the space of a year, Harkin needed money. To save it from bankruptcy, Saudi banker Khalid bin Mahfouz injected $25 million into the company. The transaction was negotiated in great secrecy in Geneva. The money arrived from Union Bank Suisse and the Bank of Commerce and Credit International, the BCCI, numerous drug and terrorist connections. That also was a primary vehicle not only for the Iran-Contra and Iraq-gate affairs, but it also was used to help finance the anti-Soviet Afghan Mujahideen. It was that conflict, the anti-Soviet war, Afghan war of the 1980s, that saw the genesis of Osama bin Laden and World Trade Center bomber Ramzi Youssef as warriors. Now, note the Union Bank of Switzerland. I've noted the connections of the milieu of François Jeannot to the milieu of bin Laden and the milieu of September 11th. François Jeannot, a key disperser of post-World War II Nazi funds, that disbursement inextricably linked with the Martin Bormann organization, about which we've spoken many times in the past. One of the financial institutions that has loomed large in the background of numerous things, including the funding of the World Trade Center, is the Union Bank of Switzerland, alleged in the L'Espresso article to be one of the financial institutions that helped to back George Bush Jr. The Bush family, with strong financial connections to the Third Reich, their post-World War II business interests funded in considerable measure by the liquidation of the Union Banking Corporation, not to be confused with UBS, that was a Nazi front company, or confiscated as a Nazi front company in World War II. We're going to turn once again to the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, authored by Paul Manning and published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, copyright 1981. ISBN number 0-8184-0309-8. As mentioned in Side 1 and in many other broadcasts, Paul Manning, part of the CBS News team that covered World War II in Europe with Edward R. Murrow, broadcast the surrender of Japan and Germany on the CBS radio network, trained as a gunner aboard B-17s and B-29s to cover the air war in Europe and Japan, respectively, and flew combat missions, then investigated the Borman Organization and accessed numerous intelligence and U.S. Treasury files in order to do so. Reviewing again some of the connections between the Union Bank of Switzerland and the Borman Organization and the very powerful IG Farben Nazi Chemical Company, turning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in exile, they would agree to this because the honor of Swiss banking and its principle of banking secrecy would be at stake. In addition, 25% of Interhandel, that's the holding company that into which IG Farben's stock was folded at the end of World War II, beginning again, in addition, 25% of Interhandel stock would be registered in the name of Union Bank, that's UBS, whose manager, Dr. Alfred Schaefer, was of known integrity. The Swiss believed the association of such a man of high banking repute at Interhandel would impress American government authorities. But the German connection would still be there. Not only IG Farben head Hermann Schmitz, but also the banking connection of Union Bank of Switzerland, Dr. Schaefer's bank, and Deutsche Bank, which acted in concert on so many deals involving not only IG Farben, but also big Ruhr industrialists such as Thyssen AG, the largest steel maker in Germany. And also, by the way, with strong connections to the Thyssen AG, that is, with strong connections to the Busch family. The family of Thyssen-Bornemisza is based in Lugano, Switzerland, where the aforementioned Altaqua was also based. What we're going to take a look at now, and bearing in mind some of the Borman connections to UBS and to some of the Middle Eastern petrodollar milieu that we've been looking at so far, what we're going to take a look at next concerns the some more about François Genoux and some of his financial connections, turning once again to the Southern Poverty Law Center's intelligence report number 105 from the spring of 2002, the article The Swastika and the Crescent by Martin A. Lee, of Genoux and his post-war disbursement of Nazi funds. Where did the money come from? According to European press accounts, Genoux was managing the hidden Swiss treasure of the Third Reich, most of which had been stolen from Jews. Quote, security services claim he transferred the defeated Nazis' gold into Swiss bank accounts, reports Gita Sereni, who called Genoux the most mysterious man in Europe. Unquote. So that, again, some of the connections, although the Borman Organization is not mentioned there, that is who handled the post-war Nazi funds. Genoux, of course, with numerous evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of the milieu of September 11th. Now, as I'm speaking on 4/14/2002, the Middle East has exploded in the last several weeks. As I said before, passions are running high and intellects low in connection with this. One of the things which has been distorting public opinion in considerable measure has been the tremendous wealth that has been flowing out of the Western industrial nations, the U.S. in particular, in the direction of Saudi Arabia, the home of the Wahhabi sect, and also some of the other reactionary Middle Eastern regimes. This wealth has not only served to finance Al-Qaeda and the Islamofascist milieu that I've spoken about in the past. It is one of the things that overlaps the Borman Organization. It has helped to distort public opinion, not only in the U.S. and elsewhere. It also has had a profoundly distorting effect on Islam itself, with the ultra-reactionary Wahhabi sect now wielding a large and disproportionate influence within the Islamic world. What we're going to look at now concerns Saudi bankrolling of the, quote, martyrs, unquote, in the Middle East. In a number of broadcasts, including For the Record Program 340, we took a look at the fact that Saudi Arabia bankrolls the PLO and always has. That's also discussed in For the Record 348. I would note that the European Union and Germany in particular bankroll the Palestinian Authority. Research credit on this goes to a member of the listening audience who got this from the UPI website. It's www.upi.com. This is an article datelined Washington, April 9th. It's headlined, Saudi Arabia sets aside $50 million for, quote, martyrs, unquote. It's by Pamela Hess, UPI's Pentagon correspondent. And again, this is April 9th of 2002. The Saudi Arabian government has paid out at least $33 million to families of Palestinians killed or injured in the 17-month-old Intifada, and in December of 2001 earmarked another $50 million for the payments, according to Arabic news agencies and the Saudi embassy's website. Similar payments promised by Iraqi President Saddam Hussein have drawn sharp condemnation from U.S. President George W. Bush and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Note no criticism here from either of those two petrodollar/Saudi-linked individuals. Continuing. The Saudi Committee for Support of the Al-Aqsa Intifada distributes payments of $5,333 to the families of the dead and $4,000 to each Palestinian receiving medical treatment in Saudi hospitals. The fund is managed by Saudi Interior Minister Prince Nayef bin Abdulaziz, according to the embassy. The sum is far less than the $10,000 Iraq offers to the families of those killed and the $25,000 it gives to kin of suicide bombers, but is nonetheless significant to the average Palestinian whose annual income is $1,575. Again, $50 million is earmarked for these families. The average Palestinian's annual income, $1,575. And the Intifada payments from Saudi Arabia, over $5,000 plus $4,000 to each Palestinian receiving medical treatment. This is one of the things that has helped to distort the situation in the Middle East. And again, Yasser Arafat himself and his PLO are bankrolled by Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, again, is the home to the ultra-reactionary Wahhabi sect. Its history itself inextricably linked with the history of international fascism. What we're going to be taking a look at in for much of the duration of the broadcast concerns some of the petrodollar connections, and not only the connections of oil wealth to American corporations, but in turn, how that is helping to distort American public opinion due to the fact that as monies dry up or as money becomes scarce, which it is becoming more so all over the world, nonprofit foundations and also universities are increasingly struggling for petrodollars and Saudi wealth. What we're going to do is to turn to a book that we looked at in our last program, namely, for the record, 354. That book is called In the Name of Osama Bin Laden, subtitled Global Terrorism and the Bin Laden Brotherhood, published in softcover by Duke University Press, authored by Roland Jacquard, J-A-C-Q-U-A-R-D. The paperback edition, ISBN number 0-8223-2991-3. Now, once again, of the SECO, that's the Geneva-based European branch of the Bin Laden investment, the Bin Laden company, the Saudi investment company, Yaslam Bin Laden, now under investigation by French and Swiss authorities in connection with September 11th. The co-chairman of the board of directors of SECO is Baudin Dunant, who in turn was an attorney for François Genoux. Pay close attention here to the Fluor Corporation, one of whose subsidiaries is part of SECO. We're going to take a look at its influence in the U.S. and in helping to shape public opinion in a minute. Turning to the name of Osama bin Laden, Ronald Jacquard writes, "The projects awarded to the bin Laden group are no longer limited to the Saudi kingdom. In Lebanon, Yahya bin Laden is involved in the reconstruction of downtown Beirut devastated by the civil war. In London, the group has a branch office, Bin Export. In Geneva, SECO, the Saudi investment company, is involved in many international deals. This company, established by the Bin Ladens in 1980, is the flagship for the group's activities in Europe. It is headed by Yaslam Bin Laden, and the board of directors is made up almost exclusively of members of the family clan, except for a Swiss citizen, Baudin Dunant. This well-known lawyer from French-speaking Switzerland, who was on the boards of several dozen companies, came to public notice in 1983 when he agreed to represent the Swiss banker François Genoux, a controversial figure who had been a disciple of Hitler and the sole heir of Goebbels' copyrights before becoming one of the financiers of the FLN during the Algerian War. The friendships of the Bin Ladens sometimes seem surprising, but they are logical. François Genoux has always been pro-Arab. SECO, as the parent company of the group's foreign interests, also has offices in London and in Curaçao in the Dutch Antilles. The latter outpost, established in 1984, also manages, among other things, the relations of the Bin Laden Group with that of an American company, the Daniels Realty Corporation, a subsidiary of the Fluor Corporation, which, through the influence of the Bin Ladens, was awarded many reconstruction contracts in Kuwait after the Gulf War. Now, bear in mind the Fluor Corporation and its connections to the Bin Laden petrodollar milieu, also inextricably linked with the Bush family. What we're going to take a look at now is an example of the shaping of American public opinion through the influence of petrodollars. We're going to turn now to the book The American House of Saud, subtitled The Secret Petrodollar Connection. This was authored by Stephen Emerson, was published in hardcover by Franklin Watts, and the ISBN number for this book is 0-531-09778-1. What we're going to take a look at here in a chapter called Academia for Sale is the influence of the Fluor Corporation and the petrodollar milieu within the American academic community, in this case, the University of Southern California. Turning to the American House of Saud. In fact, by 1978, over 90 American colleges and universities had tried to obtain direct Saudi aid. Of the 90 schools that sought such aid, only three were initially successful in their quest: the University of Southern California, Duke University in North Carolina, and Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. The three were strategically located in different parts of the country. Of these three, the first recipient was the University of Southern California, or USC. In 1976, it received a Saudi grant of $1 million to establish the King Faisal Chair of Islamic and Arab Studies. By the way, the King Faisal used to hand out copies of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion to each of his personal visitors. Continuing. Though the endowment of chairs in American universities is hardly rare, USC granted the Saudi government an extraordinary privilege: the right to approve the selection of the chair's occupant and participate in the selection of all its future occupants. Professor Willard A. Belling, B-E-L-I-N-G, a professor of international relations who had previously worked for Aramco, was appointed to the chair less than 5 weeks after a letter was sent on March 26 from a Saudi government official to USC President John Hubbard stating, quote, "It is our understanding that the first incumbent of the chair shall be Professor Willard A. Belling," unquote. Saudi Arabia's choice of USC as the first American university to receive such financial largesse was not mere happenstance. USC had long been a favorite of many Saudi officials. An old boy network had sprung up due to the scores of illustrious Saudi graduates, including Dr. Ghazi Al-Ghusaibi, the Saudi Minister of Industry and Electricity, Dr. Soliman Sulaim, the Minister of Commerce, Hisham Nazir, Minister of Planning, 14 deputy ministers, 200 Saudi businessmen, academicians, and other government officials. In 1977, an alumni chapter of the university had even been started in Saudi Arabia at a dinner party attended by USC President John Hubbard. Hubbard had become a believer in the USC-Saudi connection. Interviewed in 1978, Hubbard, whose office was adorned with a picture of him and Saudi King Khalid, said, quote, "I am absolutely convinced that they've been moderate on oil policy and OPEC because of the USC connection," unquote. Now, bear in mind the Fluor Corporation inextricably linked with SECO that we alluded to earlier. In 1978, the relationship between Saudi Arabia and USC took a quantum leap forward thanks to the actions of J. Robert Fluor, the chairman of USC's Board of Trustees. Fluor was the head of the Fluor Corporation, a California firm started by his grandfather in 1912, which had emerged as one of the world's largest engineering and construction firms. The Irvine-based firm built multi-billion dollar mega projects such as oil refineries and oil drilling platforms throughout the world, ranging from China to South Africa. Saudi Arabia was Fluor's biggest customer, generating more than $5 billion in contracts from the construction of the Saudi gas gathering system. The 56-year-old Fluor, a former U.S. Air Force pilot who raced thoroughbred horses, had become an early Saudi supporter among the American business community. In 1975, his firm produced favorable documentary-style films on the kingdom for showing throughout the United States. And in March of 1978, Fluor himself sent a letter to 40,000 of his company's employees, stockholders, and vendors, as well as to members of Congress, urging them to support the sale of F-15 air superiority planes to Saudi Arabia. In May of 1978, the month the Senate voted on the F-15 sale, Fluor endeavored to prove his Saudi loyalty on a much more ambitious scale. He invited 40 executives from the top American multinationals, such as Mobil, Litton Industries, and Exxon, to a breakfast meeting at the Biltmore Hotel in Santa Barbara, California. His purpose was to raise funds for an elaborate $22 million Middle East center designed to enhance understanding of Saudi Arabia. The center was to operate autonomously within the University of Southern California, quote, to prepare both undergraduate and graduate studies for academic, business, and governmental careers relating to the Middle East, to facilitate academic research on the area, and to provide research and related services concerning the Middle East to the non-academic community, unquote. The Middle East Center was also given a voice in the selection of faculty in other departments of USC. The fact that the proposal still awaited official university approval was not mentioned to the executives. Citing the need for good public relations, two prominent Saudi speakers, Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Saud Al-Faisal and Industry and Electricity Minister Al-Ghossabi, quote, whose approval, the New York Times noted, is required for any major industrial deal with the Saudi government, made strong pitches for contributions. The Saudi Arabian government, however, would not make any donations, said Al-Ghossabi, because that would undermine the credibility of the center. Fluor immediately followed the Saudi speakers with a direct appeal to the businessmen's self-interest. Contribute, he told them, and your company will be remembered by Saudi Arabia, unquote. As the executives departed from the hotel, they were handed a brochure describing the Middle East Center, plus individually tailored requests for contributions ranging up to $1 million. By September of that year, over $7 million had been pledged. The money was supplied by a handful of American firms whose executives had attended the breakfast with Fluor and from the East-West Foundation, a nonprofit charitable arm of the Fluor Corporation. On October 4, 1978, the trustees of the university voted to approve the center, despite the fact that they would not have total control over the center's decisions and programs such as curricula and selection of faculty. Many faculty, however, protested the arrangement and actively challenged the trustees' decision. In a unanimous vote, the Faculty Senate voted to disapprove of the arrangements and procedures as academically unacceptable. Yet the trustees would not budge from their support of the center. And as the Middle East continues to explode, I want to note, and we will deal with this at greater length in the future and have in the past, note the interdiction of the peace accords that were taking place at Camp David in the summer of 2000. This is an arrangement under which there would have been a Palestinian homeland, 95% of the occupied territories would have been returned, and the Palestinians would have shared Jerusalem as a capital. Yet the Palestinian negotiating team turned this down. That would have been a tremendous boon to the Gore campaign. Turning again to The Secret War Against the Jews, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens and published in hard and soft cover by the St. Martin's Press and copyright 1994. Note the composition of the team that turned down this arrangement. Note also that the day that oil man Dick Cheney was named as oil man George Bush's running mate was the day that Yasser Arafat walked out. Yasser Arafat and the PLO again bankrolled by Saudi Arabia. Of the composition of the Palestinian negotiating team, Loftus and Ahrens write, "The CIA secretly brought several moderate Palestinians to the United States for intensive briefing. This group, codenamed Baker's Dozen," by the way, proteges of a former Secretary of State under the elder George Bush, James Baker, a key player in the Carlyle Group, "this group, codenamed Baker's Dozen, included most of the official Palestinian negotiating team with Israel. Quote, Hanan Ashrawi, Hana Senora, Saeb Erekat, Sari Nusabeh, and other lower-ranking Palestinians were summoned to Langley for a three-day conference on integrating their politics with the United States." And the long and the short of it was that Bill Clinton was not able to successfully broker a peace settlement in the Middle East, and that certainly did not help Al Gore's chances. We've dealt with that in the past. More about that in the future. Bear in mind that James Baker, whose proteges those Palestinians were, watched at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel at the Carlyle Investor Conference as the World Trade Center towers went down. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program number 355, The Ties That Bind, Part 3, being recorded on April 14th of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.